This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, and today we'll be discussing If There Is No Struggle, There Is No Progress, Black Politics in 20th Century Philadelphia, published by Temple University Press in 2022. I'm joined by the editor, Dr. James Wolfinger, and two of the chapter authors, Dr. Stanley Keith Arnold and Dr. Alyssa Ribeiro. If There Is No Struggle, There Is No Progress provides an in-depth historical analysis of Philadelphia politics from the days of the Great Migration to the present. Philadelphia has long been a crucial site for the development of Black politics across the nation, and this volume emphasizes how Black activists have long protested against police abuse, pushed for education reform, challenged job and housing discrimination, and put presidents in the White House. If There Is No Struggle, There Is No Progress demonstrates that Philadelphia must be central to any analysis of African-American political history. But politics means more than elected office, and the book highlights political strategies such as the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work movement and the Double V campaign. It demonstrates how Black activism helped shift Philadelphia from the Republican machine to Democratic leaders in the 1950s and highlights the election of politicians like Robert N. C. Nix Sr., the first African-American representative from Philadelphia. The book highlights grassroots movements and the intersection of race, gender, class, and politics in the 1960s, and shows how African Americans from the 1970s to the present challenged white Mayor Frank Rizzo and helped elect Mayors Wilson Good, John Street, and Michael Nutter. Today, I'm pleased to have the editor and two contributors. Dean James Wolfinger serves as Dean of the School of Education at St. John's University in Queens, New York. In addition to editing If There Is No Struggle, There Is No Progress, Dr. Wolfinger wrote Philadelphia Divided, Race and Politics in the City of Brotherly Love from University of North Carolina Press, and Running the Rails, Capital and Labor in the Philadelphia Transit Industry from Cornell University Press. Dr. Stanley Keith Arnold is an associate professor of American history at Northern Illinois University. His scholarship focuses on the civil rights movement outside the South and the intersection of race and sports in the United States. He wrote Building the Beloved Community, Philadelphia's Interracial Civil Rights Movement and the Origins of Multiculturalism, 1930 to 1970, from University Press of Mississippi. And his forthcoming book, Beacons of Their Race, African Americans and the Olympic Movement, 1896 to 1948, explores the impact of African American athletes on the early Olympic Games. Dr. Arnold's chapter, The Great Depression and World War II, analyzes the gradual realignment of Black voters to the Democratic Party between 1932 and 1945, the centrality of employment as the crucial issue for Black voters, the role of women in politics, and the complex interaction of activists, community leaders, and elected officials. Dr. Alyssa Ribeiro is the Henry A. Logan Senior Professor of American History at Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania. She's currently finishing a book on multiracial activism in late 20th century Philadelphia, which is under contract with the University of Chicago Press. Dr. Ribeiro's chapter, Taking Political Power, highlights the complex coalitions that elected Black mayors, the role of labor politics, the shadow of the carceral state, and the manner in which Philadelphia cannot be understood outside the wider national landscape of austerity politics. Welcome, all of you, to New Books in Political Science. Forward by Heather Ann Thompson and Jim Wolfinger's introductions start with the MOVE bombing in 1985. And this is familiar to many of us, but not to people who are not yet born or who have not lived in the United States in the last decades. So since this tragedy frames the book's narrative, I just wanted to start with a quick reminder of what happened in Philadelphia on May 13th, 1985, and just the sort of short version of why this event is such a big part of the frame for this book. I don't know who wants to take that.
I can get us started, Susan, if you like, and then welcome Alyssa and Stan to join me. So the MOVE bombing is one of those flashpoints in Philadelphia history that really exposed what the conditions were that African-Americans in the city faced. And it was this really kind of complicated moment because you have an African-American mayor, you have African-American members of the police force, and you have an African-American community that was devastated by this bombing. So when you read Heather Ann Thompson's foreword to the book, part of what she's getting at is how it's such a complicated history to understand urban development and understand the place of African-Americans in the city. So while it's a flashpoint for many people and they kind of have this vague, broad memory of a bomb being dropped, the book really tries to unpack many different moments in Philadelphia's African-American history to kind of complicate our narrative, our understanding of what's happened in the city over the last 140 years or so.
And I can add a bit to that. For me, the MOVE bombing is sort of a case in point of showing how, you know, sort of decades-long struggles by activists on the ground don't necessarily make enough headway with established institutions to create kind of lasting reforms and change, and instead are met with, you know, very partial token reforms along the way. And it's not until we get a sort of manufactured crisis and, you know, disaster like the MOVE incident in 1985 that it becomes clear to many more people the width of the chasm between, right, sort of institutionalized power in cities like Philadelphia and perceptions of average people on the street.
And I just want to add, to fill in for people who really don't know what happened, the police moved in to a neighborhood and tried to clear a house, and they did it by dropping a bomb. This is the city of Philadelphia dropping a bomb on its own people. People were incinerated, and it was it had got national attention, and it was certainly a flashpoint for this idea of what does a city do to its own people. There's two other sort of big frames. One of them is the title of the book, and the other is the photograph on the front cover. And the photo is of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Cecil B. Moore at a protest rally at Girard College. And the title comes from an 1857 speech given by Frederick Douglass. So if we put all of those things together, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about the framing before we go to the origin story of the book. And Stan, you may have more to say to remind people who Frederick Douglass is, why this particular quote is so essential to understanding.
Well,
politics.
A couple of things. Let me go back to the MOVE bombing. You've got to understand that the bombing in May 9th of 1985 was the culmination of an almost decade long conflict between the Philadelphia Police Department, the city of Philadelphia, and the MOVE organization. It underscores that although racial representation is important, At the same time, you have this institution that supersedes any kind of racial or change in the racial makeup of city government. Okay, and that's an important consideration. And on a personal note, my cousins lived in that neighborhood. They weren't living there at the time when it was bombed. And I had a girlfriend who lived near the original move house in Fountain Village. So we were familiar with that. So, but in terms of the title, which is, I think, is so crucial, so important, Frederick Douglass says this at a time when it's really clear that the nation is heading to this inflection point over the issue of slavery. And the wonderful thing about this quote is it can apply to so many different movements, labor, environmental, the current situation on college campuses, involving Palestine. So it's really provides this model for understanding activism, or framing activism, I should say.
Let's go to the origin story of the book and how all of the authors come to write for it. Jim, like so many books that are done for this podcast, this book begins with a conversation that's fairly random and not intended to write a book. So take us to the conversation, why you were having this conversation in the first place. It didn't come out of the blue. You'd been doing some of this work, and then how the book took off.
Right. So several years ago now, I was approached by Temple University Press, and I had my second book, Running the Rails, coming out. And the associate editor at the press asked to meet with me at the American Historical Association. I said, sure, but you know, the book's already coming out from another press. She said, that's fine. I'd just like to pick your brain a little bit about kind of the great new scholarship that's coming along on African-American history in Philadelphia. So we sat over coffee and talked, and I said, you know, David Kant is working on this. Dan Arlen was working on that. Alyssa Ribeiro is working on, and so on. It kind of ticked through all the boxes. And by the end of the conversation, she looked at me and she said, so what do you think of all this? I said, I think it would be a great anthology that you could really stitch together the newest scholarship going from pre-Great Migration, the area of what they call the Old Philadelphians, all the way into the second decade of the 21st century. And nobody's ever written that book, and they certainly haven't done it from these multiple perspectives. I said, so it'd be great if somebody edited that book someday. Right. And, you know, and she said, when do you start? And I thought, I think I just stepped right into that trap. So, you know, I started reaching out to people I knew in the field, whether it was Stan or Abby Perkis or, you know, a variety of people. And to a person, they almost all right away said, this sounds like a great project. I'm in. Right. So what it did was it allowed us to go from really the 1880s, 1890s into the 20-teens. And in doing so over that long span of time, and by having multiple voices in the book, you know, Alyssa's chapter about Puerto Rican relations with the African-American community, or Stan talking about Don't Buy Where You Can't Work campaigns, or as you mentioned, the cover of the book about Cecil B. Moore, it allowed this book to do more than any single author book really could do. Because it brought in gender and it brought in grassroots politics and formal elections for mayors, the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work campaign and the Fight for 15, the Great Migration, and so on. So the book tries to have a very expansive view of politics, and it tries to bring in many fresh new voices in the field of African-American history in Philadelphia. It's been really gratifying to see the reviews that have come out on it. Because people see the way it hangs together. As an editor, that's your job. But the meat and potatoes of the book, the content, that's Alyssa, Stan, and the rest of the team. So my real thanks to them for all their great work.
It almost reads like a single authored book in that sometimes, you know, compilations just are kind of like whiplash, and you accept that you're looking at something that's going to be look here, look there, and maybe there won't be as many connections. But actually, this in this book, it seems as if the authors were reading each other's work, were quite aware of what was happening in other chapters. So there's this nice threading through and reference back and forward. And that's unusual, too, because sometimes historians, political scientists, they stay with the chronology and they don't think it forward. This is the thing that decades later will look like this. So I really appreciated that in all of the chapters. Stan, let's start with you. We don't have Clem Harris here, but he is the scholar who takes on old Philadelphians and does this sort of earlier link to progressive politics and the complexity of those progressive politics. And then David Canton has a chapter called Building Black Philadelphia. But you look at the Great Depression and World War II, and we can never capture the all the nuances of the chapter, but take us through some of the highlights of what is so important about the realignment and the coalitions that are built in this time.
Okay. As you said, the Great Depression is really the catalyst for this realignment, and it's not necessarily fast, and it's not necessarily smooth. You've got to keep that in mind. Philadelphia, as I think so many people out there are aware, had a GOP machine that dated back to the Civil War. That was as Leland Stephan said, in the early progressive period, corrupt and contented, I should say. Black Philadelphians, specifically old Philadelphians, whom we locals refer to as OPs, were in many cases tied to this. To this establishment. Things begin to shift, however, within the Black community when you have the Great Migration of the World War I era and beyond this, and you have a large influx of African Americans escaping Jim Crow in the South, specifically the Upper South, Chesapeake Bay region, and looking for economic, social, political, cultural opportunities in Philadelphia. Things begin to decline rapidly with the onset of the Great Depression in Philadelphia. A lot of the Philadelphia, for example, had one of the highest percentages of Black home ownership in the country. Well, that collapses with the Depression. Banks collapse, obviously. Businesses and Black unemployment skyrockets. And it's really clear that neither the GOP in the White House, nor in the State House, nor in City Hall know how to handle this crisis. And it leaves African Americans looking for other means of dealing with this. Grassroots organizations begin to grow. Some people gravitate toward more radical solutions, like the Communist Party. My first book looks at interracial civil rights organizations, then you have the Democratic Party, who seeks to challenge the Republicans for the first time, really, capitalizes on this. Yes.
No, and I'm just going to insert, just because my students are always mind blown by this because they are young, and we have listeners from everywhere here, that the idea that Black Philadelphians would be so tied to the GOP is something that people need to wrap their heads around, that this is the party of Lincoln.
Right.
This is the party that has stood against, as much as it has, against segregation. So there's, so that's why this realignment is so important.
Yes.
But for a lot of people, they've sort of forgotten how entrenched Black politics were with the GOP prior to this period. That's why this chapter is so essential.
Yes, and it's there, the publisher of the Pittsburgh Courier, who says, turn Lincoln's portrait to the wall, okay? The Republicans aren't doing anything for us in this time of great crisis. It's time to begin to look at the Democratic Party. And as I said, this takes a long time to occur. Blacks support Hoover, and that is Black Philadelphians in 1932. They're concerned that a Southern segregationist is FDR's running mate. But when the New Deal begins to take effect, there is this shift. In addition, you have African-Americans like Marshall Shepard Sr., a migrant, someone who is cosmopolitan, has lived in New York City, has worked with Clayton Powell at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, who becomes a stalwart supporter of FDR. We begin to see a gradual shift away from the Republicans. But at the same time, concern that FDR isn't doing enough, which contributes to an organization like the National Negro Congress rising, which really wants to push the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction in terms of civil rights. I don't know how long I have. Or
no, I think that's a great start for us. I think, you know, another thing that you really do so beautifully, evocatively in the chapter, it's the writing is gorgeous. It really is. I mean, this is a beautifully written book. This chapter is, it's a real page turner. Is that you blend together some of the names, people like, you know, Raymond Pace Alexander, people who had been elites in the city, had been leaders in the city, and you show how, again, this is, as you said at the very beginning, this is not a straight line in which the Black Philadelphians go from Republicans to Democrats, because it's not really clear where the Democrats stand. They don't want to put anti-lynching legislation forward. FDR wants the Southern segregationists to be part of his coalition, and he wants the Black Philadelphians. And you show how these different leaders are making these decisions. And I guess one of the things I would ask you to just say a little bit about is the way people change parties, how they see opportunity in the Democratic Party, but when the Democratic Party disappoints them, they switch back. And if you just say one thing about that, I think that would be good. And we'll come back to this topic.
But yeah, so Hobson Reynolds is one of those individuals, a state legislator who's also a prominent mortician, and he will shift between the Republicans and the Democrats. It's clear that a lot of Black Philadelphians, in some cases, split the ticket when they're voting, but are also looking for who has the best solutions to what they perceive are the problems that African Americans face. The first African American woman to be elected to a state legislature is Crystal Byrd Fawcett, and she is elected, which is, in my view, something pretty promising, in a district that's 66% white, and says that, you know, her concerns are beyond issues of race. She'll become a close confidant of Eleanor Roosevelt. She'll be get involved in international affairs. However, she will leave the Democrats when she feels that they are simply not doing enough in terms of addressing Jim Crow, racism, racist violence in the South and elsewhere. And I think within this, you see the beginnings of this this fractured Democratic coalition that will exist until the 1960s of a party on one hand outside of the South that's struggling or attempting to build a multiracial coalition. And and I say attempting because there's a level of frustration that there's not enough Black leadership in some cities, including Philadelphia. This is going to change, and a party that's basically devoted to a white supremacy, centered in the South. You see the genesis of this during this period. Individuals and leaders are looking for who seems to have the best solution. And when Republicans in the 1940s start talking about civil rights, well, like people like Wendell Willkie, perhaps we should take a look at him, some say.
Right. And they also to not be captured. Right. Because if you're a captured group for any party, they can take you for granted. And I know as I was reading the chapter, I thought this is the chapter that people need to read now to understand how it is many groups are feeling that they are, in fact, not served by the parties that they have become associated with. And I just want to say that I loved the chapter in how you were talking about people. You were talking about parties, you were talking about the nation, and often those particular people's stories, just obviously because you picked them, were really reflective of this greater movement. And at the same time, you have the data about how many Black Philadelphians there are in the particular moment, where they're coming from, and how they are increasingly a larger percentage of the city. So fabulous. I recommend it, reading it to everybody. And I also think that I skipped around in the book because I knew that the two of you were potentially the guests. And so when I moved from Stan's chapter, Alyssa, to your chapter, I thought it was going to be whiplash. And instead, it was as if they were written as the perfect pair to go together, because in a lot of ways, you're also talking about complex coalitions and the ways in which people perceive somebody to be acting in their interest, although there's many more layers. But so your chapter takes us all the way to later in the 20th century. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, we're skipping over Frank Rizzo. And for those people who don't know Philadelphia politics, that's a kind of a hard skip. Actually, I guess maybe somebody could do the 3-sentence version of Frank Rizzo and the kind of way that he ruled the city.
So I'll take the bait here. So Frank Rizzo starts out as a police officer, deputy police commissioner, then police commissioner, and is elected mayor in 1971, will go on to serve 2 terms. He will, for many in Philadelphia, come to epitomize the terms law and order on the ground. There's a very famous photograph of him taken in a tuxedo with a billy club stuffed into his cummerbund, right? Which sort of, it epitomizes his image of, right, we're going to keep things under control. Many in the public perceive his administration as fairly corrupt, and they also perceive his control of the city administration and the police as a part of it as being, right, more repressive of people of color. young people, liberal, white, people with more radical politics, etc. So it's safe to say that he is a very polarizing figure in Philadelphia for, you know, almost probably a solid two decades, just about, that he's on the scene.
And I'll interrupt you. The Billy Club, the We, these are all dog whistles. Frank Rizzo's time in office was one in which he was standing for, he might not have said the words white supremacy, but that was what he was standing for. I am the mayor of white Philadelphia, and I take care of white Philadelphia. And the law and order piece was linked with an increasing idea that the lack of order is associated not with people who have committed a crime, not with actions, but with identity, that all Black Philadelphians are the threat. And no matter what they do, their bodies, their presence becomes the threat. And he used that in notorious ways, and becomes, it's getting so long that people don't remember Rizzo. And that I want to be careful about this. The podcast is going to sit in an archive forever. But anyway, Alyssa, you're not writing about Rizzo, but you are writing about what happens after Rizzo. So I'll let you take your chapter again. It is also very complicated, and you are covering a lot of decades. So you can pick and choose what it is you'd like to highlight.
So to connect back to the Rizzo piece for a minute, I do think he matters here a lot for what happens in the 1980s and even the 1990s, just because he as a figure is so controversial and polarizing that he is able to mobilize coalitions against him, right? So there's a few campaigns in the late 60s. There's a recall campaign that is ultimately unsuccessful, but under some questionable circumstances. And also he tries to change the home rule charter so that he can run for a third consecutive term. And voters reject that pretty resoundingly. But we might also think of his sort of capture of the Democratic Party infrastructure in Philadelphia as sort of taking the Democratic Party's more rightward in those years, and then actually creating this opportunity or space for more progressive activists to create alternate infrastructure, right? To use community organizations, church congregations, things like that as these really formative organizing and recruitment and turnout spaces that then are able to drive some of the more formal electoral victories during the 1980s, but also, right, help to build relationships across like a wide array of activists that are pushing back on, right, housing issues, police accountability and brutality issues, pressing back against what many folks feel is too much emphasis on downtown development in Philadelphia compared to, right, investment in the neighborhoods where most Philadelphians live. I would say one thing that was a challenge in writing this chapter is much of my earlier work had been framed a little on more so on the 1960s through the 1980s. So I very much was trying to do a deep dive into the late 1980s and the 1990s to get a better sense of how these trends sort of extend over time as the 20th century is coming to a close.
You know, I'm a political scientist, or I'm a political theorist. It depends what day, you know, you ask me, or maybe I'm a political historian sometimes, but I know I'm not a historian. And I know I'm not a historian when I read chapters like yours, because one of the greatest contributions is this super fine-grained detail that connects what's happening in the different decades. So, for example, I love what you said about Rizzo. It's not just what he did. It's how people used the idea of him to mobilize themselves. Because so much of this book is about Black activism in Philadelphia and how it is that you build those coalitions. Can you say a little bit, you open your chapter talking about how Black Philadelphians don't have the majority that they would need to just elect anyone they want. Can you lay out just a little bit about the coalition that they end up building and how long it lasts?
Absolutely. So by the 1980, I think African Americans are about 40% of the population of the city of Philadelphia. So they don't have a straight majority on their own. They absolutely need some number of liberal white votes and potentially folks like Puerto Ricans, right, to vote for their candidates as well. And it's sort of very clear to folks that, right, Black turnout is essential, but it is not enough by itself. So there are some very concerted campaigns in the early 1980s to really increase voter registration rates. So we see a jump in the early 80s. And I also mentioned, right, in this sort of mayoral election of 1983, where finally the first Black mayor is elected, W. Wilson Good, the turnout rate, right, is 60 some percentage points of registered voters, which is akin to a presidential year election, but this was a municipal only contest, right? So it sort of shows that the level of voter engagement is quite high, even in local politics. There are also sort of, if you look back at framing documents of kind of political conventions from the late 70s, early 1980s, sort of repeated references to this idea of a multiracial coalition, right? How Black and Puerto Rican interests are aligned. Sometimes it expands to be like Black, Hispanic, and white voters, right? So one of the kind of chief points I want to get across is that I think, you know, Black politics in Philadelphia is very self-consciously aware that they need to convince voters that, right, they are not only there to serve Black Philadelphians, but what is good for Black Philadelphians will be better for all Philadelphians.
Another one of the themes in your chapters that I thought was really interesting, especially together with what Stan has in his chapter, is that, you know, we see this focus on employment. This is the focus from the beginning. This is what most human beings need, which is to be employed so that they can buy things, so that they can take care of themselves and their families. And they want those jobs not to be perilous and in terms of their like physical safety, and also that they can be fired at any time. But there's, you know, complexity of who can join a union and the extent to which, you know, union politics include Black workers. In your chapter, you show, so we normally think of this sort of like jobs is really important and labor politics is really important. It, as your chapter continues, you see conflict between Black Philadelphians and the unions, particularly the teachers' unions. And I wonder if you could just unpack that a little bit, because that also shows that these coalitions are very difficult to keep together. They're not standard.
Right. And so one way to think about this, right, is you could talk about public sector unions in Philadelphia, but then within public sector unions, right, we've got a diversity of folks that are concentrated in different areas. So we might think of sort of one echelon of public sector unions being teachers, right, being police, being firefighters. Those unions are more predominantly white. They are more perceived as middle class, right? But you've also got organizations like District 33 representing sort of broadly based municipal employees that are predominantly Black. You've got, right, a sanitation workers union that is predominantly Black. And one of the things that we see is sort of varying levels of success in being able to engage with and negotiate with the political apparatus. And broadly speaking, right, the unions that are perceived to be whiter and more middle class have more success in holding on to their benefits. And the ones that are perceived to be less white and less middle class, right, generally have less success. You mentioned the schools in particular, and one of the the kind of racial dynamics that's going on there is that the teachers union remains predominantly white, while the vast majority of students attending Philadelphia public schools has become Black during this time. And so that puts many Black parents in a difficult position in terms of wanting their students to continue to go to school and get the best education. They may, in other circumstances, right, support labor unions and labor rights, broadly speaking. But in the scenario of a teacher's strike, and there are a number of them in the 1970s and 1980s in Philadelphia, right, they are more willing in that circumstance to cross a picket line to make sure that their child is going to school, right, and not missing out on that educational opportunity.
No, thanks. It's a great chapter, and it's funny because I lived through some of that, not all of it, but much of it. And I'm from New York, not from Philadelphia, and I was aware. I mean, I knew what my parents thought of Frank Rizzo, for example. I mean, those things came permeated. But one of the real values for me of your chapter is, as somebody who wasn't in the space, wasn't doing this, it really puts into perspective what was happening and why we are in the situation that we are in Philadelphia and the United States today in our urban areas. Okay, what I want to do is a conversation. So there's a few things that we missed, and so I just want to swing back. Stan, we mentioned Double V, and we mentioned Don't Buy Where You Can't Work, but then we never explained them. So if you could do a quick explanation there, and then we'll go to some of the other wider themes in the book.
Well, Don't Buy Where You Can't Work originates in New York City, Harlem in particular. And it's a concept that basically empowers African Americans as consumers and potential workers. And Reverend Marshall Shepard is a leader in this, and it focuses on West Philadelphia, but also North Philadelphia as well. I think it's good in terms of building grassroots organizing. I don't think it's perhaps as successful as New York City's. The Double V, victory abroad against Nazism, Japanese nationalism, expansionism, and victory at home against racism. This phrase was coined by the Pittsburgh Courier, appeared there, and was adopted by African Americans and others interested in civil rights during World War II. And Philadelphia becomes extremely important in the war, receiving close to 12% of federal defense funding. It's a center of manufacturing, specifically military goods, bullets at the Frankfurt Arsenal, uniforms, tents, and the textile industry, and perhaps most importantly, ships. The Navy Yard, the Sunship in Chester, and across the river in Camden. The country's largest shipbuilding center at the time. So as I was saying to an interviewer not too long ago, the civil rights movement would have been quite different had it not been for World War II, because I think, both nationally and then in Philadelphia, the World War I was a war to save democracy. And when African Americans participated either at home or abroad, and they returned home, they found that this democracy didn't apply for them. And there was a feeling that this war is going to be different. As a Black journalist, Roy Otley, wrote, a new world's a coming. And, there was a lot of hope that things would change drastically after the war.
Sure. And that the programs that followed the war, things like the GI Bill, could be applied, could provide opportunity for all Americans, and would not be withheld from black communities. I'd like to end by talking to each of you about what it is that we have not talked about that was really important to you in the writing of this book. And this could be in your own chapters or it could be elsewhere. Jim, you're the person who has the sort of eyes perhaps more into the other chapters. And I think I'll start with you. But, you know, it's an amazing book. I'm not the first person to say that. What in particular is what you want people to know about, why you want them to read the book, why you see it as important?
I would say there are a few things. One is that I think it offers a model for thinking about how we can explore the histories of many cities around the United States, Los Angeles or Dallas, Atlanta or Boston, in thinking about pulling together different authors' voices to look in really complicated ways at difficult subjects. Other scholarly areas have more of a tradition of doing this kind of work, pulling teams together, whether it's in the natural sciences, computer science, or whatever else. But history remains very much driven by sole authorship. And there's a value to that, but there's also a loss. And the loss is I would not have conceptualized a chapter about the late 20th century in the way Alyssa did. Right. You know, that people have different experiences and different perspectives, different historical lenses. So that's one thing is for how we study the past, and particularly over this long span of time, this 140 years or so that the book covers. The second thing I would say is the book attempts to offer a really complicated understanding of politics that in some ways it's about who's getting elected mayor or getting elected to Congress. But in other ways, it's about how grassroots activists energize a community. It's about the implications for gender politics on formal electoral politics. It is clearly about race and ethnicity, but there are a lot of different aspects to it, as we've highlighted, around labor and unions, jobs, around education, and so on. So it attempts to bring together multiple perspectives. And in telling these multiple stories in multiple ways, the last thing I would say is that it really highlights that this: if there is no struggle, there is no progress. The title of the book is that the struggle is uneven, and it comes in fits and starts, and there are advances, and then there are moments of reaction. And you can see that throughout the book, whether it's early on Clem Harris's work talking about Black Philadelphians thinking maybe their place is no longer with the Republican Party, but shifting over to more progressive Democrats. But those Democrats are led by Woodrow Wilson, who is known for being, you know, a very reactionary racist person when it comes to those matters. So what do you do with that, right? And you see that throughout. You see it where, you know, Stan's piece is talking about African-Americans shifting from the Republican to the Democratic Party, but they don't do it completely. And they don't do it in elections that don't feature Franklin Roosevelt, right? You know, there's this really uneven change in politics. So it fits and starts, and it gives us a little historical humility, I would say, in that we can look at people today or 20 years ago or 100 years ago and say, oh, you're doing this wrong. You're getting that wrong. How could you not have thought of whatever? And then you realize everybody is operating with imperfect information in contexts that we cannot escape from, localized understandings and so on. And you say, maybe we need to show people a little grace for the mistakes they made, the inability to see the whole picture. Because I can guarantee you, if somebody writes another book about Philadelphia Black politics in the 21st century, say 100 years from now, they're going to point out all the things we got wrong right now. So I think that's an important component of this, is to really see that history is not a straight line. History is uneven. It's fits and starts, and it's frustrations as well as triumphs. So I hope that's what people were able to take out of the book as well.
That's terrific. And I love the point about history, soul authorship, and what happens when you're forced. And Alyssa already referred to this. It's not comfortable to get out of the specific case study that you're familiar with or the specific time. Yet you have expertise that lends itself to the larger period. And so forcing yourself out of that, I think, is I find as an author to be both frustrating and painful, but also, you know, highly productive. And I think highly productive for readers. I think that we're all trained to say, like, I don't actually know about that. That's 10 years later than I study. But I think that this book really changes how each scholar has to operate. And it is part of what makes it such a brilliant book. Stan, is there something we haven't talked about that's really important to you about the volume?
I think it does provide a model for looking at other cities. A couple people have asked me about, are you going to do the entire United States? Like, that's a little too much. But I have a friend from New Orleans who said, well, somebody should do something like this on my hometown. So I think that it provides multiple perspectives. As you say, we're able to weave these all together. And for me, in my chapter, I found most rewarding the stories of African-American women who were organizing on the grassroots level and then drifted to or allied themselves with the Democratic Party. When Alyssa was mentioning unions, I had to think about the interracial unions of the 1930s, specifically the garbage workers. Really the first union of that period with Black leadership. That was, I think, quite important to me.
And in your chapter, I know something about your period, and I know something about some of the really important women in the period. I knew nothing about Crystal Byrd Fosse. Is it Fosse or Fawcett? And it really highlights how early women are involved in politics. Black women are involved in politics, not the community organizing side exclusively, but are running for office. And the way you describe the campaigns and the kind of narratives that people have, it's as if it's ripped from the headlines today. And this is still what women in politics are struggling about. So I love the idea of this being a series. I think that the way the book is organized, the maps at the beginning are essential. When I started working in Philadelphia, and people were like, "Well, that's North Philly," and I'm like, "I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, what's the difference?" The book really helps you see and understand. All right, Alyssa, I'm going to give you the last word for you. What does this book do for history, for your field, for you personally? You can do with the question whatever you like.
I think the book as a whole fits well with my own perspective on trying to sort of integrate different strains of historical insight. So I think that many of us tend to gravitate towards thinking of ourselves as social historians, right? People who are really talking about underrepresented voices that haven't been as major part of the narrative in the past. But for me, I also think it's really important to give people a realistic understanding of the economic frameworks in which people were operating and the ways that those placed certain limits on what social movements could achieve at any given moment in time. Not that it made certain decisions or reforms completely impossible, but it may at many moments have made them much less likely or required a stronger dose of public protest or public dissent to drive policymakers in a certain position. And I think, you know, overall, the field of history is turning a little more to think about, right, urban finances and how much those mechanisms create, right, relative possibility or opportunities on the ground to create change in communities.
Well, I just want to thank you, Jim, for having the conversation with Sarah at Temple Press and Stan and Alyssa and all the authors who you represent who are not on the podcast today for taking the time to put this volume together. It was a game changer for me. It's a beautifully written book. It's organized beautifully, and it's gorgeous to hold, and that still matters to me to have a cover like this that I just kept staring at for the also even the fonts, the everything about the book is beautifully done. So very nice work by Temple University Press and the figures, everything about it, just terrific. So thank you so much for joining us. I've been talking to Dr. Stanley Keith Arnold, Dr. Alyssa Ribeiro, and Dr. James Wolfinger about their new book, If There Is No Struggle, There Is No Progress, Black Politics in 20th Century Philadelphia, published by Temple University Press in 2022.